A massive sell-off on Wall Street, and already the blame game has begun.
Should we blame the government or blame society?
Or should we blame the images on TV?
No, blame Canada!
Blame Canada!
Yeah, blame Canada. Hey now. Blaming Canada is probably as good an explanation as any for the debacle on world markets. The complex global financial system is unraveling, and there seems to be no stopping it. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 16th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora. It was Canada.
It was Canada. Always Canada,
always.
Right?
Yeah.
Today, that turmoil you're talking about continues in the global markets, and the Federal Reserve will meet. What options does it have? We'll take a look at that. In Iraq, General David Petraeus has handed over the reins to a new U.S. commander. And setting trends, a new company wants you to pick out what's coming next. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
The dramatic downfall of banking giant Lehman Brothers and the sale of Merrill Lynch is taking the markets down on a swift ride. Wall Street had its worst day since the terror attacks of 2001, plunging almost 4.5%. Asian markets are seeing red this morning. In Tokyo, shares fell by more than 5%. All eyes are on a Federal Reserve meeting later today. Investors hope there will be a lowering of interest rates, but no consensus yet. There's a new man in charge of Iraq today. General David Petraeus handed over control of U.S. forces to Lieutenant General Ray Odierno at a ceremony at one of Saddam Hussein's former palaces. It's great they're finding a use for those things. So Petraeus says he's leaving Iraq better than he found it, but there's still work to do.
Coalition and Iraqi forces have given hope to a country that was on the brink of civil war. Innumerable challenges remain, and tough fights still lie ahead.
Petraeus is widely credited with quelling violence in Iraq, but he says the relative peace is fragile. Yesterday, a suicide bomber killed more than 20 people in Baghdad.
Tensions between the United States and Pakistan today are quite high. The Pakistani government is furious, apparently, over recent U.S. raids on its soil. Today, the Pakistani army says it's given troops orders to shoot any U.S. forces that make the trip over the border from Afghanistan. The U.S. is battling Islamic militants.
The House is set to vote on a comprehensive energy package today that could open most of the U.S. coastline to offshore drilling. Also, 2 million people in Texas still don't have power in the aftermath of Hurricane Ike. John McCain is all over the tube this morning. He's campaigning on the air, and he has rallies planned later today in Florida and Ohio. Barack Obama is campaigning in Colorado, and Joe Biden is talking about the economy all over television. Oil prices continue their downward trend below $92 a barrel. That's a headline.
That is, considering just 2 months ago it was $147
a
barrel.
Incredible. Big companies are going bankrupt. We're talking about the contraction that's taking place on Wall Street. What evidence in your life do you see of the bankruptcies and the bank failures that are the constant story, at least in the last couple of weeks, on Wall Street? You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Are you coping personally with the failure of Lehman Brothers and the sale of Merrill Lynch?
And what questions do you have about what is happening to the economy, both here in the United States and globally? We'd like to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Tuesday, September 16th. It's going to be another uncertain day on Wall Street, trouble in the U.S. market. Also sent shockwaves throughout world trading, even before Wall Street opened on Monday. and ended up dropping 500 points. London's FTSE fell more than 2%. Japan's Nikkei index dropped 5% to a three-year low, and shares in South Korea and Hong Kong shed almost 6% in value. For more on the world markets and their reaction to the weekend where Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy and Bank of America put a bid in to buy Merrill Lynch, the Financial Times market reporter Michael Hunter joins us now. And Michael, yesterday the Asian markets were closed. Today they're opened, and boy, are they down.
Yes, Asia's had its first chance to react to what we saw happening at the weekend with Lehman, and following the pattern set everywhere in the world financial system, there have been sharp losses on Asian exchanges again. London also, while we're on the subject of world markets, that's also got a lot worse since last we spoke, I'm afraid, Adora. We're now looking at losses of another 167 points on the main benchmark index in the square mile.
And so you have in Japan, as well as in Australia and India, attempts to pump cash into the money markets. Have any of those attempts been mildly successful?
Well, it's actually quite hard for us to tell that while market trading is live and while the system is still trying to react to what's happening. But suffice to say that the European Central Bank has seen fit to join that central banking trend. They've pumped an extra 70 billion euros of emergency fund into the system. The Bank of England has also followed suit. It's extended its facility to lend an extra £5 billion of cash to the system until Thursday, and there's an additional 20 billion pounds of cash coming in today. So you can tell from those actions that the system is still creaking, and it will take some time for us to ascertain whether or not that medicine is providing a cure.
Michael, those sound like extraordinary amounts of money, and that must be indicative of just how concerned the world markets are.
Very much so. I think there's such a pronounced lack of confidence in not just the market, but also in the whole world financial system at the moment, that kind of in many ways all bets are off about what might happen next. We've had various different opinions expressed to us from London today about what might happen with the Federal Reserve tonight. Some people have been saying that it's likely they'll keep rates on hold. Others have predicted a 0.25% cut. Others have said there may be even a bigger cut of some 0.5%. I think now it's looking more and more likely that the Fed will have to act to reduce base rates today.
And what do you think they could do? Do you think that cutting the interest rates would provide some comfort?
Equities markets always like to see the cost of borrowing reduced. It helps the system move. It helps keep those financial wheels and gears in motion. And these kind of emergency interventions we've seen today in order to achieve that very same end would receive a certain boost from a rate cut in the States. So I think investors are looking increasingly towards some action from Ben Bernanke and his colleagues this evening to help the situation start to improve. Also, numbers from Goldman Sachs, who report their third quarter earnings a little later, will be very, very, very closely watched. Goldman have, of course, been very canny at weathering the worst of the financial storm that we've seen so far this year, and any disappointing numbers from them could also exacerbate pressure both on the markets and on the Fed to take some action tonight.
So Michael Hunter, certainly lots more questions than there are answers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Hunter is the markets reporter for the Financial Times, and he came to us from London. John?
And as Wall Street prepares for another trading day amidst a lot of volatility and turmoil, the campaign has started to take the bull by the horns here, or take the bear by the horns, as the case may be.
Today offers more evidence, Colorado, that too many folks in Washington and on Wall Street weren't minding the storm.
The American economy is in a crisis. It is in a crisis. People tonight will be sitting around the kitchen table trying to figure out how they're going to stay in their homes, how they're going to keep their job, how they're going to put food on the table. And America is in a crisis today.
So not minding the store, in a crisis, take your pick. The Barack Obama campaign and the John McCain campaign, the candidates are all over the television this morning reacting to the economic news. We wanted to take the pulse of at least one campaign. Jeff Zeleny is following the Barack Obama campaign for our partner, the New York Times. Jeff, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed about both candidates regarding this event and actually some others in recent headlines is just the enormity of the sell-off on Wall Street and the seeming lack of enormity of the language of the candidates in reacting to it. What sign do you have that Barack Obama has an aggressive economic plan here versus simply saying, I can handle it, we need new leadership, something much more general?
That's definitely a good observation. The campaigns have been, both candidates have been, you know, talking about the economy certainly all year, and it's certainly become the main issue of the final 50 days of the race. There's no question about that. But most of the rhetoric so far is just that, rhetoric. You had a long-distance sort of spat yesterday between the McCain campaign and the Obama campaign. Senator McCain said that he believes the fundamentals of the economy are strong, and then he went on to say that there are very big problems and that it's a crisis. But the Obama campaign seized on those few words, and in fact they have an ad out this morning showing him saying the fundamentals of the economy are strong. The McCain campaign is doing the exact same thing to Senator Obama. So you're right, at this point both of them are sort of talking about the problems as opposed to the solutions. One reason is that they don't want to be too prescriptive in terms of changing the markets or influencing things as this is unfolding in real time. But I think you'll hear more specifics as the week unfolds.
Is there any sign of the direction that the Barack Obama campaign might go? I mean, it seems to me that Americans are waiting to hear for some sense that a tangible response is coming, January 09.
No, I think Senator Obama is giving a speech. I'm in Colorado this morning. He'll be giving a speech in Golden, Colorado. He'll be laying out a lot of what he believes needs to change in terms of regulation. He's been giving a lot of these speeches for months. He gave one, in fact, on Wall Street in March, and sort of has talked about it somewhat intermittently. But he will call for new regulations of bringing the standards up to a 21st standard, is what he calls. But still not a lot of specifics, more generalities, but he believes that the problems on Wall Street are caused by these old rules, old regulation rules, and he says simply a matter of greed. So some of this also is these campaigns are not wanting to, especially the Democrats, are not wanting to appear that they are completely sympathetic or bailing out or other things, because there are a lot of middle-class working Americans who are hurting as well, and they're not exactly all that sympathetic for what's happening on Wall Street. So some of these candidates are walking a bit of a fine line on this.
Well, interesting. Criticizing Wall Street regulations, that's exactly what Henry Paulson did yesterday. I would wonder if they're actually in agreement, Adora.
And Jeff, I mean, the bottom line is it's kind of hard to come up with a solution to these massive problems in a soundbite, isn't it? And how do the campaigns, particularly Barack Obama, how do you frame it in a simple way that makes sense?
Well, I think that is one of the challenges, and which is why Senator Obama is devoting a whole speech to this topic this morning, as opposed to just giving a few soundbites at a rally. One of the things, I mean, he's trying to frame the problem. Yesterday he said it's the biggest financial disaster since the Great Depression. Who knows if that's exactly right. There certainly was a savings and loan episodes and things, but he's framing the problem, but he's also trying to frame a solution in a way that makes sense. But these candidates are campaigning in battleground states, and the people in their audiences are not necessarily people who might be in a Wall Street audience. So I think you're right. They still have not exactly struck a balance in terms of how to articulate this solution. But again,
well, let's lay out a quick little sign in the less than a minute we have before we go. Barack Obama talks about infrastructure jobs and energy related jobs. Is that a theme he's more likely to go for, or will it be the we need more regulation theme in the next couple of days?
I think he'll do both. I mean, he'll definitely talk about regulation as a given, but definitely more jobs, more infrastructure jobs. I think he will definitely do that in the speech that he's giving today.
Well, it's a good indication of a takeaway question that we want to pose. Jeff Zeleny, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jeff Zeleny from the New York Times with the Barack Obama campaign. What do you want to hear from the candidates in response to the economic developments over the last few weeks? 877-8-MY-TAKE. How is bankruptcy affecting your life? You can also call us with those stories. And also, are you good at spotting trends? All those three things on the takeaway. But especially, what do you want the candidates to say about the economy?
Yeah, what would you like to hear? I'll have to think about that.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We were just talking about the campaign and economic policy. What do you need to hear candidates say in response to the economic turmoil of the last few days and weeks? We're also talking about trends. Later on in the program, we'll have more about that. Have you ever been ahead of the curve? When have you been ahead of everyone else on a trend? John writes on our website, "When my son was born in 1987, I knew that college tuition would be around $40,000 per year when he would go to college in 2005. Professors that taught boomers like me said I would retire before my son went to college, so I determined that tuition would double when my son went to college. My wife and I save accordingly. Thank God we did." Well, okay, so you planned ahead. Fine, thanks a lot. Call us with your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Good for you, and thanks for that, John. Today, a changing of the guard. Early this morning, the U.S. military commander in Iraq, David Petraeus, he formally handed over the reins to Lieutenant General Ray O'Donnell. Petraeus has been credited with overseeing significant improvements in security across the country, but the incoming U.S. commander is warning that violence could easily escalate again. Rob Watson is the BBC's defense correspondent. He joins us now. Welcome, Rob. What kind of situation does O'Donnell take on?
Well, he takes on a situation that has dramatically improved from 18 months or so ago when General Petraeus first took command. What do we mean by that? Well, you've got a truly dramatic fall in violence. You've got some political progress, but of course, still a lot of work to do. And I think that's what General Odierno was hinting at when he took over command.
There was certainly an effort to downplay expectations.
I think so. But I think there's also, while we're about it, I think we shouldn't understate what's already been achieved. And I think, really, General Petraeus did two things. In the first place, he persuaded a reluctant Pentagon, and more broadly a reluctant Washington, to kind of stick with it in Iraq and to send more troops, because there were plenty of people at the Pentagon who are no doubt these days very jealous of him as a successful general, who were saying, you know, Iraq is going to break the U.S. military. We need to bring troops home. So he had success in Washington. And I think the other thing, and this is perhaps even more important, is that he understood that you're not going to win the insurgency by killing everybody. Indeed, as he once said, you don't kill or capture your way out of an industrial strength insurgency. Instead, he recognized that you had to address the political motivations of the Sunnis, who were essentially leading the insurgency. So he's now brought them largely on side the United States, and they've joined America in fighting against al-Qaeda. So a lot has been achieved, but quite a lot still to do.
Well, let's talk about Odierno. What is his style? What is his style like? And do you think that he, from what you understand, is up to the task?
Well, he's the kind of man that you're certainly not going to miss in a crowd. He's 6'5" tall, and he's got a shaved head, so you're not going to miss him. I'd say that he's fantastically experienced when it comes to Iraq. This, after all, will be something like his third term there, so he thinks of it as a second home. He's also been part of Petraeus' team. He was his deputy, and he was also part of that team that tried to sell the idea of the surge to the Pentagon and to a wider Washington. So I don't think you may see some differences in style, but I don't think you're going to see any dramatic change in policy now that we've had a change in command.
Well, certainly General Casey, when he was there, his whole idea was to you know, what Rumsfeld used to say, put the hand on the back of the bicycle for the Iraqis and help them to drive, you know, these sort of euphemisms for the Iraqis taking over.
Sure.
What's the strategy of Odierno and Petraeus in getting the Iraqis to take a bigger role in the security?
Well, you're quite right in highlighting that difference. You know, essentially, the U.S. policy in Iraq before General Petraeus was to say, you know, it's all about training the Iraqis so they can do the job. Now, what General Petraeus realized was that by the time that had happened, there might not be an Iraq for them to defend. You know, the place was on the brink of total collapse, near all-out civil war. He realized that the Americans had to actually be more involved by getting out into the neighborhoods, getting the troops out of U.S. bases, stopping what was known as the commute to war that American soldiers were doing, and perhaps more importantly, or as importantly, this idea of reaching out to the people that were behind the insurgency, the Sunnis, who felt that there was no place for them in a new Iraq. Now, I think you're going to see a continuation, really. What do I mean by that? Well, you're going to see that the Americans will still have a very hands-on approach, trying to coax the Iraqis out of their sectarianism. And also, of course, they will still be on the ground. But of course, yes, this training mission of the Iraqis will continue.
Well, quickly, how's the Anbar province handover going? That's an early sign that maybe what they're doing is working.
Well, it seems to be going remarkably well, and indeed the focus has now shifted to nearby Diyala province just north of Iraq, because part of the success of the American and Iraqi forces has been to sort of force al-Qaeda into places where they're not, so that the battle has now moved to Diyala. But again, all of this, briefly, is about getting the Sunnis back involved in Iraq's political and security structures, and perhaps for the longer term, trying to somehow, because this still hasn't been done, to get the Kurds, the Sunnis, and the Shiites to agree on a long-time unifying vision for their country.
And Rob, General Petraeus is not going away. I mean, his next assignment will be as commander of U.S. Central Command, with broader responsibilities overseeing all of the troops in the Middle East. So he'll still be involved.
Absolutely. He's still, if you like, in the hottest of hot seats. General Odierno will still report to General Petraeus as far as Iraq is concerned. But I think more interestingly, perhaps, he now has the Afghan baby to hold. So I guess we'll see some changes there, some reinforcements, some strengthening. So he's far from out of the action.
Rob Watson, thanks very much. Rob Watson is the BBC defense correspondent. He came to us from London, and now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got some headlines for us. Femi?
Thank you very much. Coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Share prices in Asia plunge today, and they're doing no better in Europe. The dismal numbers overseas follow yesterday's slaughter on Wall Street. The collapse of Lehman Brothers, the sale of Merrill Lynch, and now the impending implosion of insurance giant AIG have sent investors the world over into panic mode. US markets are set for a mixed open about an hour from now. The army in Pakistan is getting the green light to shoot down any U.S. forces that make the trip over the border from Afghanistan. The U.S. has been conducting raids on Pakistan's territory in recent weeks over loud objections from the Pakistani leadership. Pakistan's army says any further incursions from the U.S. won't be tolerated. The House is set to vote on an energy package today. The new plan could open up the entire U.S. coast to offshore drilling. The platforms would have to be at least 50 miles out. Democrats and Republicans are still divided over tax incentives for drilling. More than 2 million people in Texas still don't have power today in the aftermath of Hurricane Ike. President Bush will visit the battered city of Galveston, where the storm wiped out entire subdivisions. Hospitals are not yet operational, and city officials are warning of a health crisis for the 20,000 people who stayed behind, defying evacuation orders. The mayor is warning them to get out and to get out now.
Yes.
Very straightforward message.
Not welcoming at all, but then they need the time and the space for the recovery.
For
thanks,
big
Femi.
Cleanup. You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the role of fertility treatments in helping women have multiple births to accommodate their careers and lifestyles. Is it responsible? Is it ethical? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're watching economic numbers on Wall Street and off, and some numbers out of Washington off Wall Street this morning. The Consumer Price Index drops 0.1% in August. That's the first dip in nearly 2 years. Energy is the reason, but the underlying inflation rate is still fairly strong. It's up 0.2%. That's if you take energy and food out. That's called the core inflation rate. So if you look on Wall Street, there's not a lot of winners, mostly losers. 500-point drop in the Dow yesterday and the dissolution of at least two banks, Lehman Brothers going bankrupt and the sale of Merrill Lynch to Bank of America. There's more fallout on that today. But who's a winner? Well, listen to Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury.
I commend the SEC and the Fed for their work over the weekend, convening leaders of financial institutions from around the world to meet the current challenges and put measures in place to reduce market stresses.
Reduce market stresses? Well, you know, don't call your doctor if you are feeling like stresses on the market aren't reduced. If you're thinking about the economy today, we want to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And if you have a question for our next guest, Ron Lieber is personal finance reporter for the New York Times. He joins us from New York. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
We've got a lot of questions for you. Basically, people reacting to what's going on in the market, to what should they do? Is there a takeaway for them in a 500-point drop in the Dow Jones Industrial Average? Here's a first question right off the top.
Good morning. This is Troy calling from North Dakota. And I've heard certain politicians give credit to Bill Clinton for the economic prosperity of the 90s. And I've heard Barack Obama blame George Bush and his administration for the current financial crisis. And my question for an economic expert is this: how much real impact can one president have on the economy?
Ron Lieber, your answer?
I think it's a mistake at this point to point fingers, assign blame, or assign credit to anyone. You know, if there is any blame to be cast in this particular situation, it's towards, the governmental institutions that perhaps should have regulated, the mortgage industry more tightly. But then again, at the same time that many of these loans were, these loans that became trouble were giving out a couple of years ago, there was a big push from all corners, from Republicans, from Democrats, to expand access to housing. There was, an accepted fact, accepted wisdom that we should try and make everyone or almost everyone a homeowner. And, it's the troubled loans and the securities that, that the loans turned into that became part of the problem. So, on the one hand, you have a desire for increased ownership and increased homeownership. On the other hand, you have a lack of regulation that allowed a few too many people into bad loans.
And again, many actors both driving that up and now dealing with it on the way down. Derek in St. Paul put this on the New York Times website, a question directly for you. Speaking of regulation a moment ago, the insurance industry is regulated. Many, many people have life insurance with AIG or one of its subsidiaries. What is the impact of troubled AIG's financial woes on potential life insurance payouts? Should we be looking elsewhere for insurance, asks Derek.
A couple things to think about here. First of all, AIG is still in business. The insurance sides of their business remain financially sound by most accounts. They have the ability to pay out claims today and tomorrow. Now, what happens in the next couple of days because of any sort of potential unraveling on the other side, on other parts of the business, we do not know. But there are guarantee agencies and states in place that cover payouts up to, $300,000 or more in certain states on life insurance. So there is some protection, and if it comes to that, people can also file claims if the company's dissolved. So, it probably would not be a total loss. But again, we're a few steps away from that even needing to be a concern.
Here's a heartbreaker sent to the New York Times site. Tony asks, how will this affect my mutual funds and my 401k? I'm beginning to think I should move my money fast. It's too late for fast, isn't it?
bit too late for fast. I mean, we're down, you know, however far down we are at this point from the market's peaks at 20% or more. You know, panicked selling almost never works, because, you know, if you're looking and investing over the long haul, you know, the barons of Wall Street have not been able to call the bottom or figure out when the right time is was to buy in. The best you can do as an individual investor is to move slowly and deliberately, you know, put chunks of money in at various stages and diversify your assets and hope for the best. We've never seen a downturn that hasn't been followed at some point by an upturn. There's no reason to think that the financial world is changing and ending as we know it at this particular moment.
Ron, I hope you're right. I really do. Here's another one from Peggy, which was sent to the New York Times website. She writes, I'm getting ready to buy a house, and I have a property under contract as of today. What do you think mortgage rates will do?
Mortgage rates are difficult to predict on a short-term basis, let alone a long-term basis. What we do know is that mortgage rates have fallen a fair bit by, you know, almost half a percentage point in the last week and a half. You know, the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, which is what I hope most people are looking at now that we've learned our lessons about adjustable-rate mortgages, you know, that rate is below 6% last I checked. That's a great rate, you know, particularly at a time when housing prices have fallen, 20-25% in some areas. So I would say, you know, lock that rate in and do not attempt to bet on where mortgage rates will go, and, you know, hope we'll be at, you know, 5.5% in a couple of weeks.
So stop betting on mortgage rates. Lock that in. That's a good takeaway. Don't worry about insurance quite so much. And if you haven't diversified, you better do it yesterday. Ron Lieber, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ron Lieber is personal finance reporter for the New York Times.
Or should we blame the images on TV?
No, blame Canada! Blame Canada!
That's right. Blame Canada. And now, headlines from Femi Oke.
Good morning. Just getting some news in of consumer prices. They have dropped to 0.1% in August. That's the first dip in nearly 2 years as energy plunges. Now, it wasn't a good day on the Asian markets. Let me use a few descriptive words from the investment banker Alex Tang. He says that today was a bloodbath. This was panic selling. They are dumping shares. They just want to liquidate their positions. That's the end of the quote from Alex Tang, who's an investment banker in Asia. Stocks tanked following by big declines in Europe. And the Dow opens the day this morning below 11,000 for the first time in 2 months. The Federal Reserve meets today, and we could be looking at a cut in interest rate. Economists are split over whether that will happen, but most admit it's a possibility in the weeks ahead. Pakistan says that it's given its military orders to shoot any U.S. troops that make the trip across the border from Afghanistan. U.S.-led raids have become increasingly common in recent days, despite loud objections from the Pakistani government. A Pakistani army spokesman says that no incursion will be tolerated. And the U.S. military commander in Iraq, David Petraeus, who's been credited with overseeing significant improvements in security across the country, has formally handed over his post as he departed from Iraq today. Iraqi's foreign minister, or former foreign minister, Adnan Pachachi, said that he had done two things for Iraq. One was helping with getting together some of the tribal regions so that they were fighting back against Al-Qaeda, and the other was bringing some more forces into Iraq to help with the surge effort. And
thank
that's
you,
a look
Femi.
At the news for now.
Thank you very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. Does that sound familiar, John?
Oh, sure.
In the world of blockbuster books, Agatha Christie, well, she was way ahead of her time in not only spinning unpredictable tales, but introducing the world to her distinctive characters. And now newly discovered tapes give us a window into what she thought about her legendary detectives. Remember the precise Miss Marple?
Well, it occurred to me, now this is merely a suggestion, you understand, that her clothes implied someone who has times when she has money and times when she hasn't. When she has, she buys good things, and when she hasn't, she buys throwaway things. Now, that might mean someone who is in and out of work a lot, but isn't feckless.
isn't feckless. Marple was just one creation of Agatha Christie, the half-American, half-British writer. Did you know that? She was half-American. Mm-hmm. Whose books were translated into 100 languages and sold over 100 million copies.
That I didn't know.
I know, many books. You might remember her other star detective, the very particular Hercule Poirot, from the television adaptation of her books.
If Cora Galaccio announces that her brother has been murdered, and then she herself is killed the very next day, then those two deaths are bound to be considered cause and effect. And for Hercule Poirot, the prime suspect would be one of the family.
And often he was right. In the new tapes, though, we learn what Christie thought about her characters.
People never stop writing to me nowadays to suggest that Miss Marple and Hercule Poirot should meet. But why should they meet? I'm sure they would not like meeting at all. Hercule Poirot, the complete egoist, would not like being taught his business or having suggestions made to him by an elderly spinster lady. Hercule Poirot, a professional sleuth, would not be at home at all in Miss Marple's world.
That's Agatha Christie speaking. She was actually recording herself, and it said that she did much of those recordings in the 1960s. The tapes were discovered recently by her grandson, Matthew Pritchard, who said he found 13 hours of tapes in a storage room in Christie's Devon estate, and the family just released them, marking her 118th anniversary, the anniversary of her birth. And Christie, well, she spoke passionately, as we've just heard a bit about her characters, and passionately about why they should not meet.
No, they are both stars, and they are stars in their own right. I shall not let them meet, unless I feel a very sudden and unexpected urge to do so.
She never did.
No, she never did. And the material from the tapes were actually used for her autobiography. And here's her grandson, Pritchard, talking to the BBC yesterday.
She would never have done this if there had been anybody else present. She just had the machine, a microphone, and she just talked, you know.
How interesting that she did it that way rather than simply write it down or
yes.
something.
Yeah. And then she used to send, we still got the little boxes which the tapes came in, which she sent to her secretary, and then the secretary used to send the tape back and it's a fascinating sort of piece of social history. Oh,
you can hear she didn't want him to air. She's dragging the microphone through her.
She may have been a brilliant writer, but I don't know, as a technician there in recording her own story.
That's
the tapes,
fascinating stuff.
The 13 hours of tapes are great portions of them. They're actually airing on the BBC this week.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. On this Tuesday, September 16th, we're going to bring you up to date with the latest stories. Femioke is here.
Thank you very much. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Consumer prices in August posted their first monthly decline in nearly 2 years as Americans finally get a break from surging energy prices. The Labor Department reported Tuesday that consumer prices edged down 0.1% last month, and that's a big improvement over 1.1% price spike in June. Stocks are headed for a mixed open, with Nasdaq futures rising a day after Wall Street's worst day in years. The Dow lost over 500 points to finish under 11,000 yesterday. Oil prices fell below $92 a barrel in Asian trading, despite worries about the credit crisis and the effect it may have on the global economy. Gasoline prices are still rising, though, in the wake of Hurricane Ike. The members of the Upper House of Parliament in Afghanistan are holding a one-day walkout to protest the increasing number of civilian casualties in the country's conflict. A senior member of the Senate said that protests will continue if measures are not taken by the Afghan government and foreign forces to reduce the number of civilian deaths. And finally, Rick Wright, who was a founder member of Pink Floyd, has died. He was very understated about how he created his music.
It's simply that as a musician, you try and play, you try to write how you feel.
Have a listen to this track. It's called Us and Them, written by Rick Wright. He founded Pink Floyd straight out of college. He wasn't with the band for the entire duration, but he is very well remembered by fans today. He died aged 65 in the UK after battling cancer.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome, John.
You know, I've been thinking all hour. I think I have an answer to that trend question. I've actually, long before they were popular...
You mean the question that you posed to yourself about trends?
No, not to myself. I posed it to everyone. But if you've ever spotted a trend way before anyone else...
Okay.
I think I did. Back in 1979, long before Converse All-Stars, red Converse All-Stars were popular, I was wearing them. Converse All-Star high tops.
We'll check that.
How are you going to check that?
Well, we'll just look back. Google has everything.
Not pictures of me in Converse All-Star high tops.
Anyhow, we're going to check that out because we are talking about trends. It's part of a new series that we're calling Startups to Watch. We're looking at new companies and what they do. And the company we're looking at today, the startup, is eDoctor.com, a website that uses crowdsourcing to track new trends. That's why we were talking about your red Converse sneakers. Andy Thompson is the co-founder.
Why are you being so hostile about my red Converse?
I'm not hostile.
Yes,
I just
you are.
I remember
it is insane.
I remember being in first grade in the mid-70s and people wore Converses then.
All right, fine. So I didn't start that trend. Anyway, keep going.
You might have kept it alive.
You win.
You might have kept that alive. But we can ask Andy Thompson about whether or not trends that the folks on his website are pitching, whether they're keeping them alive. Anyone can pitch what they believe is going to become big sometime soon. And people pitch their ideas, they provide an argument for their trend, and then they wait for other people to respond. Right, Andy?
Right. Our system combines basically the insight of our users and also an algorithm that scours buzz across the web to kind of find where trends are going, where they're big, where they're growing.
So give us an example.
We kept the definition of trend kind of wide. You know, we have people, anything from people to places to new ideas to fashion. You know, so anything from, you know, for example, Barack Obama. Clearly, you know, he's a common concept. He's a popular figure. We're tracking his growth, his spread across the world.
You actually have an example that I read about that, which was you noticed on your website there were a lot of people from Europe who were flagging Barack Obama as a new trend, something to watch, many months ago.
When we first launched, BBC did a piece on us, and we got some really strong international users. And we noticed right away that there's a lot of attention around Barack Obama. And at first, it seemed kind of, I thought it was all in the U.S., and I looked deeper into who was behind it, and it was really, you know, people from all over the world, very well-spoken, saying why they really felt strongly that he is the perfect candidate for President of the United States.
Well, you know, you're tracking all kinds of metrics that are related to what people are referring to in their emails, who they are zapping, who they are forwarding stuff to, who they are Twittering, these kinds of things. Do you really get a global picture by looking at those, you know, some would say kind of advanced, fringy sorts of technologies?
Right. I mean, I think so. You know, the power of our system is that it's both on our site and also across the web. So the more sources of information we're pulling in from, it really makes it much more powerful of a platform. You know, it's from sentiment analysis on Twitter, you know, it's really become a big popular thing to track. You know, there's a lot of buzz around topics constantly on Twitter. And so it helps to give us a real-time look at what people are really saying.
So if I had taken a picture of my Converse All-Star high tops, red ones, in 1979, nice. Put them on YouTube or something, you would track the hits and the number of times it was forwarded and begin to get an idea, hey, maybe there's something going on here.
Yeah, and, you know, we track the influence behind people, you know, the 6 degrees of how people find trends. So, you know, we'd be able to see who started, say, you, for example. And then
so Will Smith does it, big, big deal. John Hockenberry does it.
You know, that's...
so big deal.
That's the power of the site, too, though. You know, you can find those people who are kind of the hidden influencers of this group and really figure out who has the most power over their peers.
And that's really the genesis of what you're doing here on the website, which is taking a look at exactly how people are influenced, because there's raging debates in theory in school. You were saying, example, that there are some people who say it's only a handful of folks who set the trend, and others who think it's far wider than that.
And our plan's kind of to see really what happens with this data. You know,
No, your plans are to make billions of dollars.
Oh, well, that's a nice side goal.
How are you doing with that?
Let me ask you this, though. I noticed when I went to your website that there was a hat and the color purple. This was someone back in April who said, look, this is going to be big coming, you know, in the coming months. But actually, that's something that, you know, fashionistas had been talking about back in the fall. So how much of it is really about trends generated by people as opposed to those trends that are dictated or encouraged by advertisers, say Madison Avenue?
Right. I mean, it's a weird blend of the two in a way. I mean, we're tracking stuff. People have a different idea of what a trend really is, you know, what's trendy right now. So we're kind of tracking the general movement of these grand ideas. You know, the color purple now, you know, I just saw an article the other day saying it's coming back for this fall. And then, you know, Yahoo just launched this big campaign embracing the color purple. Obviously, that's marketing, but, you know, they're doing a huge push right now to represent that color.
Did you see this rollout for this HBO show, True Blood?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's this vampire show, but they rolled it out by creating these fake products and putting these, like, graffiti campaigns.
Right.
Any way of tracking whether something like that is working?
I mean, that's also kind of the idea behind what we're trying to do, you know, to see who is really thinking this is, you know, good marketing or bad marketing, or really who thinks that's, you know, a good push for this product. So,
Who do
you think your typical users are?
You know, we're really trying to go to the early adopter crowd, thus the name Edopter. But I mean, really, it's anyone who has a passion for sharing their opinions on new things, new cutting edge, you know, whether it be technology or lifestyle. I mean, really anything.
I have to chuckle, though, because when I did go to your website, I see that Yo-Yo Head suggested that wearing a watch is going to become cool again. And I was actually contemplating that over the weekend.
Really?
Putting on a watch, because I was tired of digging around in my bag for my cell phone.
Just think how much money you could make if you could see inside of Adora's brain. Like, I mean, if you could actually do that.
We should tap that as a source for our site.
But the point is that there's so many different kinds of things on your websites, whether you're talking about fashion or politics or movies or books, or whether you wear a watch or not, or whether you wear Converse sneakers. John, I'm going to be looking for your picture soon.
All right.
But you're really tracking a lot of different things.
Yeah, I mean, we want to be at this platform where we really can, you know, track the demographics behind movements and really see where things are spreading. We think we're the first to really combine that user aspect and the human aspect and the technology.
You got any friendly venture capitalists? Are you going to go public
anytime
soon?
We're working on it. I mean, if anyone's out there who wants to help out, we're definitely, we're open. All ears open.
All ears, Andy Thompson. That's what we're going to call him. He's the co-founder of Edopter.com, a startup we think you should watch out for.
Yeah, so a lot of ears listening to that. A lot of ways to catch up with us at The Takeaway. You can find us on Twitter, Friend Feed, and Facebook.
We're following the global markets and the campaigns. We're also talking about the new trendsetters, Edopters, or early adopters. By the way, John, you said you were ahead of the times with your red Converses. Really?
John, I don't want to bust your bubble there, laddie, but my dad was a basketball coach. We lived in northern Westchester County. I distinctly remember him taking the team down to the Garden to see the Knicks play. 1968. Count it, 68. And how we amused ourselves as we were stuck in crosstown traffic was trying to spot the people wearing high top cons. So you were a little behind the trend.
Aha!
I was part of the trend when they went away for basketball shoes. There. Well, you've made Adora's day. Here's your takeaway.
Thank you.
You don't kill or capture your way out of an industrial strength insurgency.
This is Rob Watson, BBC defense correspondent, quoting outgoing U.S. military commander in Iraq, David Petraeus, on what he thought U.S. strategy in Iraq should be.
And we're asking what this week's market turmoil, what does it mean to you and your bank account? We want to hear your questions and thoughts about the current market upheaval. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
We're taking it out with Pink Floyd. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Rule number one, keep your eye on the ball, because
if you don't see the ball, you can't hit the ball. I can sit here all day with them throwing balls at me, but with my eyes closed, I'm not going to hit a single one.
Oh, poor guy. He needs to be able to see to play the game. Maybe you should try listening to the ball. In the Paralympics, you'd have to be blind to play a sport called goal ball. In fact, that's true. Soccer meets bowling, except the ball makes a sound. China meets the U.S. The blind U.S. goal ball women's team gets the gold at the Paralympics. Oh, and a lack of vision on Wall Street. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 16th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, anxiety is high on Wall Street with the collapse of Lehman Brothers and attempts to refinance AIG, the world's largest insurance company. In the midst of all that, the Federal Reserve meets today. General Motors has high hopes for a new car it's unveiling. We'll take a look. And New York Times columnist Tom Friedman says clean energy technology should be the next booming industry in the U.S. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
The markets open about 30 minutes from now. Investors are bracing after yesterday's bloodbath on Wall Street. Stocks had their worst day in 7 years. There's nervous watching of the insurance giant AIG. Its value is down steeply overnight. The company is on the brink of collapse. New man in charge of Iraq today, General David Petraeus, handed over control of U.S. forces to Lieutenant General Ray Odierno at a ceremony at one of Saddam Hussein's former palaces this morning. Petraeus is widely credited for the decreasing violence in Iraq. He goes off to command CENTCOM.
Tensions are on the rise between the U.S. and Pakistan. Today, the Pakistani government gave its troops the green light to shoot any U.S. forces that push over the Afghan border into Pakistan. U.S. troops have been staging raids inside Pakistan in recent weeks. That's despite loud objections from Pakistani's leadership. Pakistan says any further U.S. incursion won't be tolerated. More than 2 million people in Texas still don't have power today in the aftermath of Hurricane Ike. President Bush is visiting Galveston this morning. Hurricane Ike battered the city, and Mayor Lyda Ann Thomas is telling the people who stayed behind to ride out the storm to get out now.
There's nothing to come here for right now. Please leave.
The hospitals are not open yet, and city officials say a health crisis is imminent.
The House is set to vote on a comprehensive energy package today that could open most of the U.S. coastline to offshore drilling. Today's version of the bill, Democrats have backed off from calling for an outright ban on drilling, but the new draft doesn't provide tax incentives that Republicans wanted. Oil prices continue their downward trend. They're below $92 a barrel, which partly explains consumer prices down 0.1% in August, first decline in almost 2 years, although the core rate is up 0.2%. And in politics, the candidates are reacting to the economic woes. So are we. Big companies are going bankrupt. What does it mean to you and your bank account? We want to hear your questions for how the current market upheavals are affecting you. What are the street signs for you of what's been going on?
Yeah, we've heard some personal stories about what it's doing to your family. We've heard some questions about what the president can do or what Congress can do or regulators can do. What's your thought on what's happening in this midst of all this turmoil? 8778, my take.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're watching the markets and, of course, the worst drop in 7 years on Wall Street yesterday. The banking system is reacting. The Federal Reserve is going to be reacting. Americans are reacting. And also the campaigns for the presidency are reacting to the economic crisis overnight and continuing throughout the day. Joining us now is Robert Reich. He's a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He served in the Clinton administration and is currently an economic advisor to Barack Obama. Secretary Reich, thanks for joining us.
Well, good morning.
Why Barack Obama continues to speak in these euphemisms of people not minding the store and sort of generally reacting to what's been going on, rather than hearing the kind of policy prescriptions of, say, the trust-busting Teddy Roosevelt or the New Deal FDR?
Well, Obama has provided a huge host of policy proposals in terms of regulating Wall Street and making sure that Wall Street is playing by the rules. One of the problems we've had with Wall Street is that the Bush administration has not regulated. In fact, at every turn, when suggestions have been made to crack down on fraud or conflicts of interest, the Bush administration has said no. Alan Greenspan is equally guilty, because in 2004, when the federal funds rate went down to 1%, and Greenspan was urged to use the Fed's oversight powers, Greenspan also said, no, he won't do that.
Well, even Christopher Cox at the SEC was saying we don't need more regulation. I guess what I'm asking is, what would the regulatory prescription be from a Barack Obama administration? What regulations do you want specifically?
Well, I think it's very, very specific. I can't say exactly what I would want or what Barack Obama would want, but what Barack Obama keeps saying, and I think he's absolutely right, is we need to make sure that conflicts of interest on Wall Street are overcome. We've got to make sure that every player on Wall Street is providing the public and providing other investors with accurate information in terms of what is actually being provided. You see, there's actually two choices government can make with regard to what it does right now. One is to bail out major players. The Fed and the Treasury have continued to choose this option up until Lehman Brothers. But even now, the Fed has said, okay, we're going to expand the discount window. The Treasury is working with the Fed to decide to try to offer more options to investment banks right now. The other option is to regulate better so that investors and lenders and all of the participants around the world know that the American market is more transparent. They can know what they're buying. One of the biggest problems.
Well, hold on one second there. I mean, just because reacting to what Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said yesterday. I mean, Henry Paulson did talk a lot about we need to get rid of outmoded regulations and maybe bring in some new regulations. So at least Henry Paulson is talking sort of the way you're talking. But let me get you away from the candidate for a moment and perhaps more into your comfort zone. Let's say it was the Robert Reich administration who was proposing some sort of specific prescription to help us through this economic turmoil and to deal with hardships on the part of Americans. What would you propose?
Several things, John. And again, I think Barack Obama is proposing exactly the same things. In terms of the markets right now, we've got to make sure that the credit rating agencies are no longer being paid by the issuers of major stocks. We've got to make sure that the balance sheets of the investment banks are no longer providing a lot of ways of hiding off-budget items so that people cannot trust the budget sheets. We've got to make sure, for example, that the securities that are being offered are marked to market, and the particular investment banks that are providing various securities are offering balance sheets that people can trust. You see, at bottom, John, the crisis on Wall Street is not a capital crisis. It's not a solvency crisis. It's a crisis of trust. Nobody is going to deal with the street. Nobody is going to buy securities, or at least they're going to be valued at very, very low rates, because nobody knows what the risk is that they're getting involved with. And this is a problem that really transcends the sub subprime mortgage problem. It's been building for years as Wall Street has become more and more excited about new instruments, derivatives on derivatives, credit default swaps, all sides of collateral debt instruments, things that even the people on Wall Street, the traditional managers, executives, and traders, don't really know what they are dealing with. A couple of years ago, I asked a hedge fund manager to tell me
what was actually in this hedge fund. Mr. Secretary, let me just interrupt you there.
And he said he didn't know.
For 1 second, you listed some very complex and intricate financial instruments, as well as some issues that are fundamentally complicated. And to be honest, it seems like some economists don't even understand them. Do you think, in talking about the confidence, how do Americans weed through the bottom line of some of these issues so that they can understand what you or any member of the McCain team might suggest as solutions to the problems?
Well, there are two ranges of solution. I think most people can understand lack of transparency and conflicts of interest. Most people understand the word fraud. Most people understand that Wall Street has been for years engaging in some fancy, very, very complicated instruments and securities that that nobody understood. And it was fine as long as everybody was winning. But as long as when the tide turned in the other direction, and some of the promises were broken, particularly with regard to the beginning of that mortgage-backed securities meltdown, suddenly all the other promises became doubtful.
Well, and certainly a lot of the banks themselves actually became doubtful.
What I'm just suggesting, and I think. Senator Obama is suggesting, and many others who are observing this meltdown are saying, is that instead of providing more and more bailouts, what is needed is more and better regulation.
All right. Well, let's talk about the banks. I mean, as this crisis has unfolded, certainly a lot of people have at least made their way through the transparency and discovered a lot of the risk and lack of value. And as a result, some banks are going out of business. Do you support, and does the Barack Obama campaign support the consolidation of banks that's going on, Bank of America buying Merrill Lynch, the increasing size of J.P. Morgan? If it, for instance, it's already bought Bear Stearns, would it buy AIG, you know, that sort of thing?
Well, I think banking consolidation is fine, John, as long as we don't get ourselves in a position where banks have so much power over the market, individual banks, that there are antitrust concerns.
Isn't that going to happen, though, if the banks get bigger and bigger and bigger?
Exactly.
Well, at some point, absolutely, yes. I mean,
so what is that point? What is that point?
Well, I think if we consolidate down to five or six huge mega banks, that's not necessarily going to be good for the country.
So how do we stop that?
Well, I think it's important that antitrust authorities get involved here as well. You know, one of the background conditions for all of this, and it's not being talked about as much as it should, is that American consumers, the middle class, can't borrow any longer. I mean, as housing prices have dropped, as the credit markets have become more and more clogged, people find that their lines of credit are gone. That, combined with the fact that median wages have actually been dropping over the last 8 years, means that the vast American middle class cannot continue to spend money. And if they can't continue to spend money, they can't continue to buy all of the things that are being generated by our economy,
which is a
downward cycle.
Right, but if, as a matter of federal policy, we loosened credit to the middle class with the declining wages, and they're able to borrow more, don't we find our way back into this crisis again, where more defaults lead to more failures and more people out of work?
Yes, and that's why a tax cut for the middle class, combined with more investments over the long term in their education and their training and their health care, and stronger unions, are all fundamentally important to this whole story. You can't talk about Wall Street without talking about Main Street.
So it's your understanding that today Barack Obama, if, you know, in a perfect world and was giving a speech economically, that one of the prime recommendations you think should be stop the consolidation of the banks, get antitrust involved in some of these acquisitions, and a tax cut for the middle class.
Yes, I mean, I can't speak for Barack Obama on every detail, obviously, John. I'm a very peripheral advisor, but I would say, make sure that antitrust is used with regard to making sure there's not too much power in the banking systems centralized, but continuously watch to make sure that the middle class and the lower middle class have enough purchasing power to continue to keep the economy going.
It's a great analysis, Robert Reich, and I did not mean to push you into, you know, sort of the inner circle there in the Barack Obama campaign. I understand you are an advisor and a peripheral one, but it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, John.
Robert Reich, professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley, former Secretary of Labor for Bill Clinton.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Right smack in the middle of turmoil in the world's markets and turmoil in the world's energy markets, General Motors is celebrating its 100th anniversary. And in honor of it, it's rolling out a car, an electric car, not an all-electric car, but very much the answer General Motors hopes to making it to its second 100 years. It's called the Chevy Volt. Chevy Volt's an electric hybrid car. It has an engine on board, but it is an all-electric engine that drives the wheels. What is the Volt? Well, on the line for GM, or on the line to talk about what is at stake for GM is Jamie Butters, business and automotive editor for the Detroit Free Press, who's actually at today's rollout. Jamie, thanks for being with us.
Sure thing.
You know, the success of the Chevy Volt is very much going to spell the fate of General Motors over the next decade or so, but it's already a bit of a failure in the sense that the fact that it has an internal combustion engine to charge the battery on long trips on board is an indication that they failed to solve the battery problem, which was so frustrating that they've been working on for quite some time. Jamie?
Oh, no. For this concept, it was always supposed to have an onboard generator. I mean, it's they can't make a battery that would work like an electric car the way we always hoped they would. And they're trying to not repeat the mistakes of the EV1, which, despite its passionate handful of fans, wasn't really a practical enough vehicle for most of us to use, enough to sell in the hundreds of thousands or in the millions. And this car, you know, it's closer to it. It lets us do the things we normally do. Part of the genius of the Prius was that nobody had to change the way they acted. They went to the same gas pumps. They didn't have to do anything weird like plug in their vehicle. 10 years later, we're used to plugging in our cell phones every night and plugging in syncing up our iPhones and whatnot. And so, I think maybe people are willing to plug in every night. But I mean, the plan for the Volt was never to make it all electric that way.
Well, certainly the plan for the electric car was to get off of the internal combustion engine somehow, but I guess the Chevy Volt, if it's really popular, suggests that we will be using gasoline for some indeterminate time of the future, maybe, you know, another 50 years.
Sure. You know, the thinking is that there will have to be a variety of power sources. Toyota, for instance, I'm sorry to keep going back to Toyota, but they really pioneered the mass marketing of a lot of this. They believe in hybrids as, you know, it's got to be the ability to take energy from multiple sources so that whichever is most cost effective is the one you use.
So,
I mean, electricity comes from coal,
right?
And this actually, the Volt specifically is gasoline and electricity from a regular household outlet, but it's part of a broader powertrain architecture called E-Flex. That basically, you know, it's an electric power to the wheels, but the flex is that they can use diesel, they can use gasoline, they can use biodiesel, ethanol, alcohol, whatever, as well as electricity. They could, use solar if they can, get enough energy out of solar panels. The idea is to have the flexibility to adapt to, the market.
That's eventually. I mean, now it's gasoline and electricity. What's the cost to operate this thing?
Well, it depends how you use it. It's going to be not a cheap car. Right. That what we're seeing today is the production rollout. It'll be the first time we see the production design. So it'll still be more than two years before they start making them, if they can figure out the battery technology well enough to work just to the more limited goals that I've described, not a pure electric car like you were hoping for. So even then, let's say it's a $40,000 car that can carry four people comfortably. If you drive it 40 miles or less, like the average person in their commute is less than 20 miles, mm-hmm. if you just drive to work and back and plug it in every night, you would never burn gas. It would only cost you the extra drainage on your electricity.
But, Jamie, before we even get there, I've read some articles talking about whether or not GM is even going to be able to get the car built.
Oh, sure. There are still hurdles on the battery technology. They have not all the way solved their battery problem.
Are they going to be asking for money from the federal government in order to move forward with the capability to actually build the car?
Well, even under the tightest interpretation of the way the government loans were originally structured in last year's energy bill, the Volt would qualify for some help. I think it's something they would do either way. If they're not going to go bankrupt, they will invest in the Volt, with or without government support. But it is the kind of thing that they'll hold up to the government when Rick Wagner, chairman and CEO of GM, goes with Bill Ford and others to Washington to say, we're trying to help get to a more energy-independent future, and since this is for the greater good, we'd like some taxpayer support in funding that. That they will hold up things like the Volt, absolutely, to make that claim.
Well, there's a little more engineering between now and reality, but there's certainly going to be pageantry today in Detroit as GM rolls out the Chevy Volt. Jamie Butters, thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
Jamie Butters is business and automotive editor for the Detroit Free Press. Again, they're rolling out the Chevy Volt like minutes from now in Detroit. Now we have headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. It's coming up to 28 minutes past the hour, and the markets are poised for a mixed open after a stomach-churning drop on Wall Street yesterday. The opening bell rings at any moment. Investors are keeping a very nervous eye on AIG, the insurance giant. The company is teetering on collapse. It needs some $70 billion in loans to stay afloat. The world's largest insurance company has lost more than 90% of its value this year. The UK bank Barclays PLC is interested in buying some Lehman Brothers assets. Barclays had dropped out of earlier merger talks over the weekend. The bank announced its interest in buying some assets that would be attractive to Barclays shareholders at the London Stock Exchange this morning. Traders are also watching the Fed meeting slated for later today. Investors are hoping the central bank will lower interest rates to provide some relief to the faltering markets. But there's no guarantee the Fed wants to step in. The government has been taking a hands-off attitude to the financial turmoil rocking the US markets. And consumer prices fell in August for the first time in 2 years. The Labour Department is reporting a 0.1% decline, and that drop could be thanks in part to low oil prices. Oil is going for under $92 a barrel, down from a record high of $147 a barrel, and that was back in July. In Cuba this morning, officials say that the fallout from the recent storms has devastated the island. They say that hurricanes Gustav and Ike have caused the worst destruction in the country's history, around $5 billion worth, and the storms damaged nearly 450,000 homes. They are going to be cleaning up for probably years, actually.
AIG and pre-market trading is down 34% or more, so they're losing more money as they've been downgraded by S&P. And also the Dow Jones Industrial Average futures is down 159. So in the next 30 seconds,
yeah, exactly.
it's going to be rough in the early going. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
We'll be right back. The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the role of fertility treatments in helping women have multiple births to accommodate their careers and lifestyles. Is it responsible? Is it ethical? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In the early going on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 165 points. That's the beginning of the day. Lots more to come on the market, including a 2:15 announcement from the Federal Reserve on interest rates. Will they lower them? Will they keep them steady? We'll find out later on this afternoon. We were just talking a few minutes ago about General Motors rolling out an electric car, the Chevy Volt. Now, you'd think that in a hot, flat, and crowded world, the presence of an electric car would be a positive thing. But Tom Friedman, who titled his latest book Hot, Flat, and Crowded, wants companies and institutions to be more strategic as they approach the green revolution and not simply be reactive. Tom Friedman, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Great to be with you, John. Thanks so much. It's been a while.
It's been a while. Yeah, it's been a while. It's so great to talk to you. And, of course, you know, you've rocketed to the to the pinnacle of the universe since the last time we've talked. But enough about that. The days of a subprime planet are over, you write. A planet we could own for no money down, where there were no interest payments until sometime far into the future, and all the true costs were hidden. Now, that is a great prescription. We could be talking about GM there, but we could also be talking about the entire U.S. economy. What's a subprime planet?
Basically what I was talking about, John, was the United States, but as a metaphor for the larger problem we face. You know, my book is really, it kind of masquerades as an energy environment book, but it really is a book about America. And the kind of meta-argument of the book is that we've kind of lost our groove as a country. It has to do with a lot of things. It's post-9/11. It's the end of the Cold War, having lost our big competitor, the Soviet Union, and the edge that comes with that. And it's the fact that our government doesn't work anymore. It can't solve any big multi-generational problem. And the argument I'm trying to make in the book is that, you know, the world's biggest problem is it's getting hot, flat, and crowded. America's big problem now is that, you know, we've lost our groove, and I think we get our groove back as a country by taking the lead in solving the world's biggest problem.
That's really what
the argument is.
So then if GM rolls out an electric car today, you would say what really needs to happen is not just one company introducing another product, but it needs to work in tandem with all sorts of institutions, government, private sector, public sector, and we need to see that the real cost of production of that car is in the price. How do we do that?
Well, you know, you're definitely on the right track as far as I'm concerned, which is that I think it's great that GM is rolling out the Volt. God bless them. It's a little late, but better late than never, and hopefully it'll inject some life and opportunity back into GM. But it seems to me that what we need is, it's often, people ask me, like, what I think about Boone Pickens' plan for building all these turbines by himself, and that's
wind energy. He calls us the Saudi Arabia of wind. Anyway, go ahead.
Exactly, and I think that's also like a good sign, like the Volt. But what we need, basically, is an economy that is reshaped, the market that is reshaped around the incentives, both the price signals, the standards and regulations. So GM won't just have one Volt. So a billionaire named Boone Pickens won't just go off and build some wind. But so that we stimulate hundreds of thousands of innovators and hundreds of thousand garages to try 100,000 things around green energy, 100 of which will be promising, 10 will be great, and 2 will be the next green Google and the next green Microsoft. Because I believe energy technology is going to be the next great global industry.
So, Tom, essentially you argue that the priorities are upside down, citing an example of the pet food companies in this country spent more on research and development last year than U.S. utilities did. How do you create those incentives to switch those priorities?
Well, you know, it's only through the market. I'm a capitalist. I believe the American marketplace is actually the greatest innovation engine God ever created. This combination of markets, venture capital, research universities, and national labs. It's a great thing we have here. But markets have to be shaped. They have to be shaped with the right price signals, a gas tax, carbon tax, et cetera, have to be shaped with the right incentives for clean power. And right now, the market signals that still dominate our energy market aren't to produce ET. The market signals are there really to support the fossil fuel industry, and that's what ultimately has to be changed.
Well, to make those kinds of broad strategic strokes, I would imagine, is going to be really, really challenging in an environment where you're reacting to crisis after crisis. I mean, yesterday the Dow fell 500 points. The candidates today are saying, oh, we're going to study this, we're going to react to this, but it's very hard to step back and do big strategy in this kind of an environment.
John, I couldn't agree with you more. What makes me weep so much about this crisis is precisely the fact that we do need a change in price signals. You're not going to get strategic investment at scale, and this is a scale challenge, the ET, the energy technology revolution, without a reshaping of the price signals, without at least someone coming along and saying, well, I can't put a gasoline tax or a carbon tax on in this environment, but let's put a floor under it. You know, let's say gasoline isn't going to fall below $100 a barrel or whatever. Even that's probably next to politically impossible in the current environment.
Wow. Well, you know, you are one of the writers in the history of the world who can describe women in Indonesia as like trees and get away with it.
And Tom, let me warn you, this is one of John's very favorite points of your book.
Well, it's so interesting. I mean, if I tried to do that, I would probably be, you know, dragged out of the studio. But you explain the argument why raw labor exported by Indonesia in the form of maids is like the way they export trees.
Well, you know, the anecdote in the book really comes from seeing all these Indonesian maids in an Abu Dhabi airport, wondering who they were at first, and how come there were so many of them. And an Indian man I was standing with was explaining to me that, you know, unfortunately, you know, Indonesia was in the business of exporting 350 maids, which was the number of these young women on our airplane, rather than, you know, one high-tech educated worker. And I made the analogy that it's a bit what goes on with their timber industry, that because they are unable to add much value in Indonesia itself, what they do is chop down 100 of their beautiful trees, export them into China. China then turns them into furniture and wood products with much more value add, and then exports them to the world. And the point I was making is if Indonesia could do that, if it could actually capture all the value from that tree, it would just need to export one tree rather than 350, just as if it could educate its people, it would only need to export, you know, one educated, you know, technology worker rather than 350 uneducated young women.
Well, it's a nice argument, except that if Indonesia gets into finished goods, we still lose the forest because now there are more people chopping down trees.
Yes and no. It really depends because basically, you would need many fewer trees to build higher value add. And at the same time, the more you educate your population, the more people you can actually get off the farm not having to chop down trees at all.
Well, he's adding value to us. So we're talking to Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times and author of Hot, Flat, and Crowded. But we're going to take a moment to get some headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. 20 minutes to the top of the hour. The House today votes on an energy package that would open most of the U.S. coastline to offshore drilling. Markets in Asia tanked, followed by big declines in Europe. The Dow opens the day below 11,000 for the first time in 2 months. It fell in the first few minutes of trading down even more to 10,765. Computer company Hewlett-Packard is axing nearly 25,000 jobs over the next 3 years. Half of those cuts will be in the U.S. Hewlett-Packard says that it wants to focus on cutting costs. And officials in Galveston have a message for residents there. Get out and stay out. That's all your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. Continuing now with Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times and author of the new book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded. Tom, we talked about education a moment ago. If the U.S. is to seriously retool its labor force for ET, environmental technology, how much time do we have to accomplish such an enormous task?
You know, one of my favorite lines on this subject, John, is from the late and great environmentalist Dana Meadows. And whenever she was asked a similar question, she'd always say, "We have exactly enough time starting now." And I really believe that. And the nice thing, in fact, not just the nice thing, the great thing about the ET industry as opposed to the IT industry is that ET, energy technology, has a big blue-collar, what they call green-collar element. So many homes are going to have to be retrofitted in terms of insulation. So many solar panels will be able to be installed on people's roofs. To build a solar concentrator project like is on the drawing board for outside Phoenix today, you're talking about between 1,500 and 2,000 construction jobs, as much steel as the Golden Gate Bridge. So what excites me about the ET revolution is that it cuts across the entire economy from the lower-skilled manufacturing and blue-collar jobs, green-collar jobs, right up through, you know, inventing the new, the newest or reaching the newest frontier in photovoltaics.
Although, you know, the Chevy Volt's going to cost $40,000. The price of photovoltaics is pretty high, pretty steep at this point. Are you saying we're going to accomplish this creation of new industry without the demand pull of consumers buying stuff that's energy efficient?
No way, no how. And you're exactly right, John. And that's why, you know, what I'd love to see is two things. One is every state government and the federal government go out and put in an order for Chevy Volts for their fleet. Use the buying power of the government to buy power, to drive down the cost of these new technologies. And at the same time, create a law that will give anyone a substantial tax write-off if they buy a plug-in electric car. You got to create the demand out there that will pull these technologies down the cost-volume learning curve till they get to the China price, the price that allow them to scale in India and China.
I guess if you wrote a book called Hot, Flat, and Crowded, and everybody reads it like everybody reads your previous books, you can say that you're advising everybody, but are you working for any of the campaigns?
You know, I don't at all. Both of them, we sent actually a copy of the book to every member of the Congress and the Senate. Everyone's got it. I'm an equal opportunity person in this regard. I'll talk to anybody who's interested in talking to me about promoting these ideas, but I don't work for anybody.
Do you detect a difference between the McCain campaign and the Obama campaign regarding this broad agenda that you've laid out?
Well, you know, I was excited about this campaign initially, John, because I thought that we had two green candidates. I don't feel that anymore. I think John McCain's gone off the wagon with his call to eliminate the gasoline tax over the summer, which only would have increased driving, increased consumption, and driven up the price of gasoline. He failed to vote for any of the renewable production and investment tax credits for wind and solar. And lately, he's landed on the mantra of drill, baby, drill.
What about Obama before we go?
Obama, I think, has stuck with his program about renewable energy. I'd still like to see him talk about it more forcefully and energetically, but I think he stayed on the wagon.
Well, there's a great takeaway. Tom Friedman criticizing the greenness of the candidates as we get close to the election. Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times, author of Hot, Flat, and Crowded. Thanks for being with us, Tom.
Appreciate it, John.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning on this Tuesday, September 16th. We want to bring you up to date to what's happening this morning, the latest stories. Femi Oke has joined us with those.
Thank you very much. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. General David Petraeus is handing over command of U.S. forces in Iraq to Lieutenant General Ray Odierno. Over the last 12 months, Petraeus has brought some stability to a country that was on the brink of civil war. As he went through his official handing over ceremony, he spoke very highly of Lieutenant General Ray Odierno.
As the multinational corps Iraq commander, the operational level architect of the surge, General Odierno brings to MNFI the ideal mix of skill, experience, understanding, and leadership quality.
Meanwhile, General Petraeus will take over as head of the U.S. Central Command, which oversees all U.S. military involvement in the Middle East, including parts of Pakistan and also Afghanistan. Consumer prices in August posted their first monthly decline in nearly 2 years as Americans finally get a break from surging energy prices. The Labor Department reported Tuesday that consumer prices edged down 0.1% last month, and that's a big improvement over 1.1% price spike, and that was back in June. Stocks are in the red across the board a day after Wall Street's worst drop in years. The Dow lost over 500 points to finish under 11,000 yesterday, and it fell more than 100 points at the open, but has made some modest gains in the latest trading. Are you checking?
Down about 60.
Great.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average, anyway.
I could tell. You were looking over at the TV screen. Oil prices fell below $92 a barrel in Asian trading. And that's despite worries about the credit crisis and the effect it may have on the global economy. And gas prices are still rising, though, in the wake of Hurricane Ike. Let's look at some of the main stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
Thank you very much, Femi. The 2008 Paralympics in Beijing is winding down this week. And although the mainstream media didn't cover them nearly as closely as the Olympics in August, Americans are walking away with many golden moments.
4 seconds left. Chen with the final chance delivers the ball into the middle, and the USA take the gold.
That's the U.S. women winning the gold in goal ball. It was a tight game, but they pulled it off 6-5, and Jen Armbruster is one of those players. Congratulations, Jen.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And it was a very exciting game, it sounds like. 6-5. There was a lot of back and forth. Describe what it was like.
Our coach said it best, probably. It was like two boxers in the ring. We traded punch after punch after punch with them. And we were up by one, we're tied, we're up by one, tied, they're up by one. So we just, you know, last one standing. And we were fortunate at the end. Our defense held, and we were able to hold them off.
That's very funny. You said your coach, as in your dad, Ken Armbruster, who's also on the line with us. Hi there, Ken. Congratulations to you.
Good evening, or good morning, I guess, back in the States.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Explain to us how, for those who are not familiar with goal ball, explain how it works exactly.
Go ahead, Jen.
Oh, okay. Basically, it's the same dimensions as a volleyball court. It's a 9 by 18 meters. Our goal goes the whole length of the back line, so it's 9 meters. Everybody plays blindfolded. And our orientation lines, where we regularly see painted lines on a court, we have thin string underneath to know where we're at. 3-on-3 game. If anybody played dodgeball as a kid, it's the reverse of that. So that, you know, getting out of the way, we throw ourselves on the floor about 80 times a game. And if we're successful, we're blocking the ball that many times. Just like a soccer goalie, you dive and so you hit the ground and get smacked around a little bit.
But to deal with the visual impairment on the court, the ball actually has to make a sound. And as exciting as the game is, and when I watch goal ball, I notice this, if people are screaming in the bleachers, it's a real problem.
Yeah, it's a tough situation. I mean, it's hard as a fan, actually, because you can't respond until whistles are blown and there's a goal scored. And when you're going in the home country and you got 6,000 Chinese fans, the refs had to do a good job of trying to control that a little bit. There's some oohs and ahs and some things and just that concentration. But, yeah, the crowd has to be quiet during the actual play, and then they can erupt after the goals and stuff are scored or timeouts or anytime there's a break in play.
How do you learn to hear where the ball is?
I think it's just like any kind of hand-eye coordination sport growing up before I lost my vision. It's just the training of a hand-ear sport and really concentrating on listening and putting your body in front of the ball that way rather than, you know, tracking visually and putting your hand on a ball that way.
Ken, what was the strategy here, do you think, that put you just that one goal ahead of the Chinese?
I'd have, you know, we had a throw-in plan before the game. We played the Chinese a couple of times this year. We actually defeated them in an overtime over in Sweden back in April. And, you know, we played them in the prelims, and they shut us out 4-0. It was a long, you know, we played 8 days in a row. And I believe they were a little bit tireder than we were. We had been able to make some substitutions earlier in the tournament where he basically went with the same three players all the way through. Uh-huh. And I was pretty sure, you know, that if we hit the spots, they have a very good defense. I think you had the audio of Bill Thiel on there earlier, and he called them the Great Wall of China. They played that good a defense. And Asia Miller, as she scored all 6 points, she was throwing hard. And, you know, it was probably one of the best games I've ever seen an individual put on a performance on a women's goal ball point.
Let's talk about ball control for a moment. I mean, when you launch that ball from one side of the court to the other, does it help if you have spin on it? Can you keep it from going straight without having it go across one of the penalty barriers?
Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I mean, there's it's just like being a pitcher in baseball. We can throw curves, reverse curves. Asia's ball reacted to this particular kind of floor real well. It's a different floor than we play in the States. We used to play on wood surfaces. This is a Terraflex floor, a little bit more bounce to it, and her ball was skipping well and probably actually picking up speed. And we're busting around 38, 40 miles an hour anyways, and I'd imagine with that floor, it was probably closer to 43, 45. It really picked up speed well. Ball was beautiful on that floor.
Jen, I need you to pipe down right now because I'm going to ask your dad, Ken, what's Jen need to work on as far as like ball control and the spin and you know, what she need to work on?
She has actually, Jen's probably one of the most accurate throwers there is in the world. Yeah, she's, you know, she got a great curve. And actually, she talked about the floor. She has such a smooth delivery in the States on the wood floor. But over here, it took something off her throw because the Terraflex was biting to it, and so it had more of a grip. But, you know, this is Jen's fifth Paralympics, so, and, you know, I've coached her for, you know, 16, 17 years now. I don't think there's much more I can tell her. She's a pretty good player.
And she's got the gold now, so she's not listening to anybody. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, especially, exactly, Dad. What can you tell her now? She's got the gold.
You know, it comes down, you know, ever since we've got here, we've been around the world a lot of times playing, and actually there were a lot of tears when we played Germany the other night because one of their players that's been around for a long time is retiring, and we've had the Spanish coaches came up and give Jen gifts and throw that whole thing in case we don't see you again because, you know, there's question about whether, you know, this is going to be the end for us or not, but you know, we said after Athens we probably weren't going to do this again, but, you know, here we are 4 years later, so.
Well, it's quite.
Yeah, we'll see what the next couple of days say.
It's quite an amazing community over there. We've been asking everybody in the Paralympics who we talked to on the show here what their favorite moment watching or being in the stands and witnessing was. Jen, what was your favorite sport to witness?
Well, like you said, we played for the first 8 days of competition, so we haven't really got to see. We've got to watch a lot on television and. I worked on the Lakeshore Foundation as well, so it's been actually I've caught the basketball teams and rugby's, you know, final tonight, and it's just been great really to watch some of my other athletes that I see all, on a regular basis training down the Lakeshore. A couple of my sports camp kids, I ran into the long jumper that, you know, I took to a sports camp when he was 15, you know, got a silver medal, and just to watch really actually some of the sports camp kids come and succeed. One of our swimmers got a gold medal, so. I think that's actually a bigger achievement for me is to watch some of these kids that we work with at camps and various sports come up and watch their dreams come true as well. So.
That
well,
is a great story,
I think
guys. Good
luck. You
couldn't
have wrapped it up better. Congratulations again to both of you, and thanks so much for hanging in there and coming on to the Takeaway with us.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
It's Jen Armbruster, captain of the U.S. women's goal ball team and Olympic gold medalist, and her dad, Ken Armbruster, who is the coach of the U.S. women's goal ball team.
Say it fast. Goal ball, gold medal. Goal ball, gold medal.
I know. Lots of gold, ways. Gold ball,
that's
gold.
Right. Gold ball, gold. Right. Lots of ways to catch up with us at The Takeaway. You can find us on Twitter, Friend Feed, and Facebook. Here's your takeaway.
We've kind of lost our groove as a country.
Speak for yourself. That was author and columnist Thomas Friedman with his unique assessment on our problems here at home.
And what does market turmoil mean to you?
This is Leslie from Rockaway. With regards to the economy and affecting our family, well, we're concerned about Christmas. We didn't have a vacation. We barely bought the kids any school clothes back to school. We're now concerned about the holidays and what that's going to bring with everything else. My husband's job is on the line.
Thank you so much, wow. Leslie. Some tough, really tough times for people. We want to hear what your thoughts are on the economy. How are you coping? What are you concerned about? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.